And then you understand when you know the answer. And now you understand when you know the answer.
In the name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. Today we have our 10th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing with our topic of Muslim contributions to civilization. More specifically, we'll be looking at the fields of geography, agriculture, industry, and commerce. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of Black Horizons. Islam in focus.
Wa alaikum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
We always take a few minutes at the beginning of our program to highlight the main points that we touch on in our previous program. Could I ask you to quickly summarize the main points that we talked about last week when we were dealing with the field of medicine?
Okay. We talked a little bit about the contribution of Muslim to medicine. And first, we tried to show the relationship between Islamic teaching and interest in medicine and how they are intertwined. We also reviewed the some of the major contributions of Muslim physicians to medicine all the way from the 8th century down to nearly 13th century, and we indicated how the works of many famous names such as Avicenna and Rhazes and Abul Qasis became and continued to be very crucial and very important references for medicine, in some cases as late as the 18th century. We talked a little bit towards the end also about the hospitals, how they were run, and how the physical care and hygienic conditions were really comparable to what you might consider as the standard of today. In addition to that, we can also add just a little bit of a remark since we're on the topic, that they used to have very rigorous standards also for who practices medicine. In fact, it's said that in the beginning of the 11th century, a patient died in Baghdad, which is now in Iraq, as a result of a mistake by a physician, and the caliph at that time ordered that all physicians should be re-examined. And it is narrated that as many as 860 medical doctors were re-examined, and since that it became a tradition in many colleges of medicine in Baghdad, Cairo, Cordoba, and other places to have very rigorous examinations for doctors before they practiced medicine. And in fact, even within Islamic law, they developed a whole body of literature dealing with the responsibility of the doctors in case of a mistake. Dealing with subjects such as what is the responsibility of the doctor to practice medicine if he's the only one available. That becomes a very sacred duty that you cannot say it's my right, it's a duty if he's the only one available to look after people who are sick. The fact that a person should be qualified, and that goes back to the days of the Prophet, when prophetic tradition even said that the person who treats others without being capable, he is responsible for his deeds. It depends also on the intention, whether the doctor really intended hurt, whether he followed the normal standard practices in medicine, and whether he took the permission of the patient. So even in the law and medicine was an issue which was also part of the study of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming to today's program and the contributions of the Muslim community to the field of geography, could you perhaps explain for us how contributions in this particular area of geography are related to the teachings of Islam?
Similar to the development also of medicine, and then for that matter, astronomy and mathematics also, you find it somehow related to the Islamic teaching. For example, a Muslim has to pray five times every day, with the face directing towards the Kaaba, the Holy Kaaba, the first house to worship God built by Prophet Abraham, which is now in Arabia. Well, that requires the ability to find directions, and that requires mathematics as much as it requires some knowledge of geography too. Every Muslim is required once in a lifetime, if he's able to go to Mecca for pilgrimage, and that again requires knowledge of astronomy to lead him on the way. They didn't have the jet liners we have today. He would have to know something also about geography so that he wouldn't get lost on the way. So Islamic teaching in a way provided the impetus and inducement for people to try and understand these fields. Another aspect is that Islam by its nature is directed towards the entire mankind. It's a universal faith of God. And Muslims have the duty to carry the message of Islam to other parts of the world. Many Muslims feeling this sense of duty acted both as merchants and callers, inviters to Islam when they visited so many parts of the world. Some historians say that the first to write about China were Muslim geographers as early as the 9th century. It was narrated in a previous program how Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, encouraged people to learn and said, seek knowledge even if you have to travel to China. And how the Quran itself even encourages people to siru fil ard, to walk in the expanse of the earth and try to learn and explore. And that, of course, provided this inducement to try to find out and explore the world around them. In fact, it's not an exaggeration to say that at least Muslims contributed a great deal to what led to the discovery of the New World or Americas, if not even preceding Columbus.
Now that's a very interesting point, which I'm sure is truly the curiosity of many of our viewers. Could you perhaps elaborate a little bit on that and explain?
For example, Ernest Renan, French author, wrote in his book about one great famous writer by the name of Ibn Rushd, in English, Averroes. The book is called Averroes and Averroism. And he mentioned in that book about a letter that was written by Christopher Columbus in Haiti, dated October 1498. In that letter, Columbus admits that one of the sources that led him to theorize that there is a new world was the writing of Averroes or Averroes. This is just again an adaptation of Averroes or Ibn Rushd, the Muslim scientist and philosopher of the 12th century. And he considered that as one of the impetus or the inducements for him to seek this knowledge. Some authors, however, claim even that it is quite possible that Muslims came and discovered the Americas before Columbus. In fact, it was found that some tribes, that's, you know, indigenous tribes before Columbus in Mexico, had many Arabic words in their daily usage, and that some believe that some tribes used to speak Arabic, actually, in Mexico, which comes back from Muslim background. But the least to be said is what Columbus himself admits, that it was Muslim writing that led him to the New World, if not actually Muslim coming before Columbus. And the least also to say, perhaps, is that Muslims realized that the earth is a sphere or round.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite crucial, again, in how Columbus made his trip to the Americas.
Well, I'm sure when you made mention of the fact that they contributed to the discovery, that they're truly curious of our viewers, but I'm probably they're even more curious about the mention of the fact that Muslims have been to America perhaaps even before Columbus. Is there any evidence to substantiate that fact? And how far back did Muslims make this discovery
on the earth is round or sphere?
Yeah.
Well, it appears that this even took place before even the 9th century. I'll give you first some quotations and references to the Quran that seem to imply that the earth is round, and one would not be too far off assuming that some Muslims, at least if not all, some could understand or get some hint from these references. In chapter 79, verse 30 in the Quran, it talks about the earth, and it says, وَالْأَرْضَ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ دَحَاهَا. The earth after that, God دَحَاهَا. دَحَاهَا was interpreted most commonly to mean made it expanse or spread it out so that we can easily walk on it. In fact, if you refer to the Arabic English lexicon by Edward W. Lane, he indicates that Dahaha also in Arabic means through or cast, impelled, or notice, propelled as the stone is cast away. And that's an interesting reference. As the stone is cast away, something propelled, which might give a hint of the origin of the earth being possibly part of a heavenly body, that just a part that supports it. But besides that, when we talk about something like a stone which is propelled, well, you're really talking about something that cannot be flat. You're talking about something which is, more rounded or spheric in nature. But there are certain verses in the Quran that's even more obvious than that, which some people sometimes misunderstood in the past also. In several references in the Quran, it talks about the earth being madadnaha, usually translated spread out. Like, for example, in chapter 13, verse 3, 15, verse 19, in chapter 50, verse 7. In all of these, the term madadnaha, or mad, is used. As Sheikh Sha'rawi, Muhammad Musalli Sha'rawi, indicates, he said that these verses, in fact, is a clear evidence and a clear hint that the earth is round. Why? Because it means that whether you go to the North Pole, the South Pole, or to the equator, anywhere in the world, the earth still spread out before you. Now, if the earth was a square or triangle or anything of that sort, then you walk and you reach the edge and you fall. Mm-hmm. See the point? But the fact that the Quran says that the earth is always spread before you, regardless where you go, it means that it's got to be, yeah, it's got to be round or spheric. In the Quran also, in chapter 36, a very strange expression is used. يُكَوِّرْ اللَّهُ اللَّيْلَ عَلَى النَّهَارِ. God, يُكَوِّرْ night over the day. Now, the word يُكَوِّرْ in Arabic means something like wrapping something around a ball. It talks also about the day and night, that none of them precedes the other, which again gives a hint that day and night can exist simultaneously, but they cannot precede each other because of this cycle, mm-hmm, of day and night. And all of these references seem to be a clear hint for many that the earth is round. But whether this teaching were really interpreted as such or did influence the thinking of Muslim scientists, suffice to refer that as early as the 9th century during the caliphate of Al-Ma'mun, that Al-Ma'mun himself made a geodetic measurement, that's measurement using also astronomical principles. He made that measurement of the earth, and he gave its circumference, not to say the term, the circumference, mm-hmm, of the earth at 24,000 miles. Two interesting remarks here. Mm-hmm. See, when he's talking about the circumference of the earth, then he's talking about
around, yes.
Exactly.
In order to measure the circumference. Exactly.
The other interesting thing also is that the measurement that he gave for estimates always very, very close. It's just maybe about a couple of hundred miles off from measurements that's done with the most sophisticated tools, scientific tools available to us today. In addition to this, we find that, in contrast, I should say, to this, we find that according to Draper, Europe, at the time when Europe was insisting that the earth is flat, Muslims were already teaching their students geography in their schools using globes as illustration of this teaching. The same kind of conclusion was arrived at by another historian of science, George Sarton. In his second volume, first part, in page 44, he says, and I quote him, "Needless to say that all the Arabic," he means Muslim, "geographers believed in the sphericity of the earth, that the earth is round." This was definitely not really a guess. I mean, the evidence provided so far is quite clear, but even more explicitly, we find that in the writing of a great Muslim geographer by the name of Al-Idrisi, who lived in the 12th century, and we quote him again, he says that earth is round like a sphere, and water adheres to it through a natural equilibrium which suffers no variations. Now, that's amazing, because it's not only talking about the earth as a sphere, but he seemed to have some understanding also of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Like some Western historians say that it might have not necessarily been the Newton's apple,
yes,
that led him to the discovery of gravity, that the concept was already known hundreds of years before to Muslim scientists.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, are there other notable contributions to the field of geography besides the discovery that the earth is round?
Well, there were several. For example, in the 9th century, Al-Ma'mun, the same fellow who did the measurement of the circumference of the earth, he ordered also the drawing of a very large map of the world. Al-Khwarizmi, we mentioned before, a great mathematician of the 9th century,
mm-hmm,
he wrote also a book called Surat al-Ard, or The Face of the Earth, which contained several maps. In the 9th century also, a very important work published under the title Al-Mamalik wal-Masalik, which means roads and provinces. That book, according to George Sarton, is, and I quote, an important source of historical topography of the caliphate. And this book was translated as late as the 19th century, for example, in French. Similar in importance also is a book by Al-Ya'qubi of the 9th century. He called it Kitab al-Buldan, or the Book of Countries, which, according to Sarton, again in his first volume, was full of topographical and economic details.
Mm-hmm.
In the 10th century, there were many other famous geographers. In fact, Sarton mentioned nearly 10 of them, and just suffice to mention the most famous of them, Al-Mas'udi, who is regarded by Sarton as one of the greatest geographers of all times, not just of the Middle Ages or medieval times, so-called. And Sarton said that his work in geography can be regarded really as an encyclopedia. An encyclopedia which is arranged in geographical order. This kind of contribution continued a long time afterwards. For example, in the next 500 years, prominence of Muslim geographers was quite clear. Abdul Latif, of the 12th century, wrote a great deal about topography. Al-Idrisi, the one we mentioned before, also of the 12th century, lived in Sicily, Muslim Sicily, and he was particularly good in the so-called cartography, or drawing of maps. Al-Yaqut, another famous author, wrote a book called Mu'jam al-Bildan, or Dictionary of Cities, which, according to Sarton, again, is an immense compilation of geographical facts listed in alphabetical orders, including works on physical geography, archaeology, and human geography. Even some of the fields that many people regard as relatively more advanced, like mathematical geography. We find that in the 13th century, a great Muslim geographer by the name of Abul Hasan al-Marakishi wrote a book called Jama' al-Mabadi' wal-Ghayat, which included, among other things, coordinates of 130 different places in the world, which showed understanding of both mathematics and geography. And just to conclude about that last authority, Sarton, George Sarton, in the second volume, the first part, he says that no medieval writer has taken equal pains to explain the scientific methods and instruments. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, just a glimpse of the subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, now in our last several programs, we've concentrated mainly on the contribution to the fields of science. I'm sure that there have been contributions in other areas as well, for example, in the area of history and sociology, political science, literature, and that kind of thing. But in the remaining part of our program today, what I'd like to do is to examine the application of the progress and start first of all by asking you about its impact on the field of agriculture.
Well, in agriculture, we find that Muslims were able to describe many plants. One single author, for example, Ibn Awam, in the end of the 12th century, was able to describe 585 different plants to explain the cultivation of several things, particularly fruits. And many people believe that the gardens of Spain today and its fruit trees owes a great deal to the Muslim civilization. As we mentioned before in other subjects, Islamic teaching was also connected with that. For example, many Muslim scientists on their way to pilgrimage to Mecca, of course they have to travel on the road, were able to study a lot on the way. One of them by the name of Abu al-Abbas al-Nabati, surprisingly Abu al-Abbas the botanist. He used to go around the coast of Africa and the Red Sea on his way to pilgrimage and collect valuable information about different kinds of plants. They were able also to apply that in a practical way in the area of irrigation. They excelled in the use of organic fertilizers, and in fact they improved a great deal also on the breed of cattle. They introduced the silkworm. According to John Draper, he also believes that many of the valuable fruits that we have in the West in different parts were introduced actually by Muslims. They travel around, they take things from one place to the other. And he mentions among those the peaches. People also add the introduction of apricots in some places. In Sicily, introduction of the sugar cane and rice owes to Islamic civilization. The introduction of bananas and other flowers like lilac, jasmine, tulips, morning glory, roses were all things that Muslims have introduced in so many different places. And in fact, in Spain, for example, during the Moorish Empire, Muslims were able to use artificial lakes to raise fish for food. So as far as agriculture is concerned, it's really one of the greatest areas of contribution, which, whose benefit was not only limited to Muslims, but to various countries where they ruled or settled for some time.
Mm-hmm. And how about progress in industry?
Industry, likewise, of course, if you have all this scientific development, chemistry and other fields, and have this progress in agriculture, one would expect a parallel type of progress in industry, too. But among the most important things were the manufacturing of the fabrics, and more particularly things like silk, cotton, leather, for example, like in Cordoba. Mining, they were quite good in mining, metallurgy, manufacturing of glass, particularly in Syria, manufacturing of steel, as in Damascus, and also in Toledo. Many people still remember this, you know, Toledo blades. It's a part of the Muslim efforts also. Because of their knowledge also of chemistry, they were able to apply it not only in medicines, as we mentioned in the previous program, but they applied that also in the extraction of incense, the attar of roses. But also because of their great interest in learning, they devoted lots of attention to the manufacturing or production of paper. Of course, you would not expect these great libraries and volumes without a local paper industry to go with it. It is narrated that the first factory to produce paper or paper mill was established in Baghdad in towards the end of the 8th century, 794. And many historians also say that the term ream, you know, this ream of paper,
yes,
comes from the Spanish resma, R-E-S-M-A, which is based on the Arabic term resma, which means bundled. Ron Lando, in his book Arab Contribution to Civilization, gives an interesting story as how Muslims learned about printing. And he says that during the conquest of Samarkand in 707, some of the war prisoners knew about printing. Mm-hmm. So Muslims, instead of being with their war captives as other people do, they learned that from them and benefited everybody from them, and they started spreading printing as well as paper making.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the extent of the involvement of the Muslim community in trade?
Well, of course, the invention by the Muslims of the mariner compass, because of the knowledge of physics, definitely reflects a great deal of interest in trade. Many of the terms that we have in commerce today comes from Arabic terms. Tarif comes from ta'rifa. Makhazin is an Arabic word which means warehouses. And you know, in the French language, it's magazine. You know, this, the same kind of derivation. Some historians say that in one occasion there were as many as 850 commercial vessels, Muslim vessels, docked in the port of Canton in China. 850 at one time. That was the huge commercial movement that was going on. Their progress in trade and commerce was quite wide, all the way from the shores of China and India, all the way to Madagascar in Arabic, and the African coast, from the Black Sea to the interior of Asia. And there is no wonder then that you find some books, even as early as the 10th century, by Abu Qasim, about the principles of trade and commerce. So even writing on the subject was there. As an evidence of the economic freedom under Islamic rule, we find that many people migrated from France to Muslim Spain, because it was under Muslim rule, so there was more freedom. Many people migrated from Italy to Muslim Sicily, which was, of course, close to it. In fact, one contemporary economist by the name of Camille Castorina, she wrote a little paper which she presented in the 6th Annual Conference on History of Economics in the University of Illinois in Champaign in May of 1979. And she mentions there that the subject really has not been explored enough, and there are amazing evidence of Muslim strides in this area.
Could you, you don't have a lot of time, but could you perhaps share with us some of what she found out?
Well, very briefly, for example, she says that there's clear evidence that Muslims were quite advanced, and they had a very good system of money and banking. She mentioned coins that were found all the way from Scandinavia to Ceylon, and she noted even that one of the kings of Mercia, which was part of the inner part of Britain, had gold coins struck, and on one side it has the Muslim testimony, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. On the other side, it has his name, Offa, O-F-F-A, Rex, R-E-X. And she said that the banking among Muslims, in the Muslim, under Muslim regime, reached a level in Islam not to be attained in the West for several years afterwards. The term check comes from the Arabic sak. And she mentioned, surprisingly enough, that there have been cases of people in the past using a very elaborate banking system, even letter of credit, rather than carrying cash all the way from one place to the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very interesting information. Unfortunately, we don't have time to pursue this any further in today's program. We want to thank you for watching and invite you back next week when we'll continue with our series. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allah 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 Allah